Sunday morning at 8 on Hometown Heroes, a World War II Marine born in northern New Mexico remembers being a teenager on Saipan shores.
I looked out at that water and I said to myself, if I could swim home, I'd be home now.
Hometown Heroes, Sunday morning at 8, right here on the Rock of Talk.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you're from in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have been through some pretty incredible things, things you and I would have a hard time imagining. All for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service, the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, sometimes even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And a member of that generation joins us today, Warren Smith of Fresno, California, 89 years old. But you weren't born in Fresno. You were born in the land of enchantment, is that right?
Raton, New Mexico. 1925.
And where in the world is that? I've never heard of that town.
That's up next to the Colorado border, right south of Trinidad, in the Four Corners.
And I know you came out here to the San Joaquin Valley very young, but you went back and forth a little while. And is it true that your way of getting to school in New Mexico as a young boy had nothing to do with a bus or a car or walking?
That's exactly right. We rode horse to school in the spring and fall was a long ways. In the wintertime, we was about 4 or 5 miles from school.
In the winter, at elevation on the New Mexico-Colorado border, at how old?
Oh, from 6 to 9.
So you're a six-year-old on horseback in the snow.
Right. Snow wasn't that bad there. When it snowed, why, it would be off, melt off before the end of the day.
Well, you know, we've all heard these stories all our lives, and the joke is that, you know, when I was a kid, we had to walk to school uphill both ways, 10 miles, whatever. You actually, that's almost true for you.
Yeah, and it wasn't in Florida either.
Do you remember at that young age having an ambition or a dream or an idea of what you wanted to do with your life?
No, not really that I could think about. There seemed to be a lot of cowboys there at that time, and I thought, well, I would just be a cowboy. I got out here, I didn't know what I was going to do.
Was that a big adjustment for you?
Well, not really, because it was in 34, and the only thing was it was hot here, and we didn't enjoy that, hot weather in the summertime. And I remember telling my uncle, you have better weather here in the wintertime than we have in New Mexico in the summertime.
And I'm sure you got used to it pretty quick. For those people that have lived in this area, you know, and live here now, what was Fresno like in the 1930s and early 40s?
Well, there just wasn't as big a crowd. The kids would go work in the farms just before they'd hold school so the kids could help get in the crops, which they can't even do anymore. That's about the difference.
And you did some of that with cotton? You milked some cows? What?
Didn't do any cotton, but I did some grape picking. And the milking cows was after I got bigger.
Was that pretty hard work out in the grape fields?
Well, I didn't like it, but what kid likes to work anyhow?
Very good point. Let's fast forward to high school. You're at a rural high school, Washington Union, and something happened when you were 16 years old that changed America, changed the world, and I'm sure changed your outlook. Do you remember how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked? Do you remember that?
Where's Pearl Harbor? Nobody knew where Pearl Harbor was, but it didn't take them long to find out.
And did it occur to you at all as a 16-year-old that you might be involved in what was starting to happen?
Not really. I didn't think about it, but the people started getting drafted in the service, and I thought, well, I'm going to fly an airplane. I'm going to fly in a fighter plane, which didn't ever happen.
But you had that idea, and well, maybe, I guess, before you had a chance to make that happen, Uncle Sam made some other things happen, and you were drafted?
Right. I was drafted and chose the Marine Corps because I'd seen the glory of it, which there wasn't that much glory.
This is right at the end of your junior year in high school. So was there any hesitation on your part that you wanted to finish high school with your friends and go back for another year?
Not really.
Why was that? What gave you that motivation?
Well, because I wasn't too good of a student to start with. So I was going to have a hard time getting through school anyhow.
And what did you know about the Marine Corps before you joined them?
really nothing other than the movie that I seen of Gung Ho, which John Wayne was in.
So it's John Wayne's fault that you became a Marine.
Right, John Wayne's fault.
You did say you liked the Cowboys, so there you go. He was a cowboy and turned a movie Marine, and then you became a real Marine. Were there some moments as you went into training where you said, boy, I don't know about this. Maybe this is a little tougher than I can handle.
I was in boot camp, and I asked the drill instructor, I says, can you volunteer to go into combat? He said, don't worry about it. He says, we'll get you there quick enough. First night there on Saipan, they was shooting mortars at us, and we was on the beach. And we had a flare mortar right by us, and they were trying to get that. And I told him, I looked out at that water, and I said to myself, if I could swim home, I'd be home now.
I don't doubt it. I think a lot of guys in that situation probably felt the same way. Before you got to Saipan, I'm sure they put you through quite a bit. What do you remember about the relationships that you started to form and maybe the connection that you felt with the other guys who could wear that globe and anchor?
That's a tough question. I can't really think back about it. But they was needing people over there pretty quick, so they didn't really train us too long until they sent us over there. Probably within 4 months after I went into the Marine Corps, I was in combat.
Which is quite the contrast to guys earlier in the war. And by this point, had you seen and heard some of what the Marines had been through at places like Guadalcanal and Tarawa?
Not very much. I'd heard just a little bit, and it's all I knew that they was over there fighting. So that's the end of the story until I got to meeting the people that was on Guadalcanal and on Tarawa. That was the 2nd Marine Division, that one of them, the 1st and the 2nd hit Guadalcanal, and then the 2nd Division hit Tarawa. So there was an Army Division on Guadalcanal, too, that fought with the Marines. The same division, Army Division, hit Saipan with us, too. They took a part of it. It wasn't just Marines. There was Army there, too.
So as you're getting ready to hit Saipan, you're on the ship. You're around some guys who've already been in combat. Did you hear some stories?
I was joined the replacement of the ones that the 2nd Marines had lost before or had sent home.
Do you remember some of the kinds of things that they shared with you, or how at all they prepared you for what you were going to encounter?
They would just tell about different things, and I don't remember. It prepared me a whole lot, but I knew that they had been in a big lot of trouble there.
It just seems to me, if a kid grows up riding horses in New Mexico and then in Fresno, that a long ship ride from California to Saipan would have been something new and something eye-opening for him. What was that journey like for you?
From California, we didn't go to Saipan. We went to Hawaiian Islands, and we trained there for a bit, and then we went on to Saipan. There was some monuments. He was watching when he was leaving to see if you could see any submarines sticking up out of the water. So that's about all there was to it.
And you kind of alluded to, you answered one of the questions I often ask guys, you know, trying to get inside their heads before they ever saw combat, if they were nervous, if they were scared, if they were, some say they were excited and couldn't wait. Sounds like maybe you were excited until you were actually there and it was real?
I was excited and I was scared too. Anybody that says they aren't scared is not really telling the truth. So I do know one person though that when we got there, he just as soon as he got there, he didn't stay with the unit. He had to get up where the front lines was, and within a day he was dead. You got to control. You got to fight as a unit. You can't take off by yourself.
Yeah, and those are lessons that you learn the hard way sometimes, as it sounds like you did. Can you help us envision what you saw when you got there? And this is 1944, so you're still a teenager. And when you got to that beach, what was going on there? What did you see? What did you hear? What did you feel?
Well, I remember seeing one dead Marine. And the front, we was on the second invaders. First drive went in an hour ahead of us. So there wasn't a whole lot of action when we got in there. But the next day we moved a little bit, not much. And there was, to show you how brave or daring those people are, there was one Japanese soldier that had hid in a little hole and covered himself up with palm trees and laid there in that hot sun all day long waiting to get out to get kill somebody.
So that was quite an education, I imagine, for a 19-year-old Marine. Do you remember what it felt like at the end of that day after, well, now I've seen a little bit of it, I've tasted it, and do you remember what that felt like or what you might have been thinking?
No, just wondering when it would get over with. That was about all.
What was your specific role within your unit? What were you armed with, and what generally were you expected to try to do?
I was an assistant BA Arman, so I had to carry his ammunition and stay with him.
And when you say carry his ammunition, so he's got that BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, which is pretty heavy, but you're carrying, what, a couple bandoliers worth of ammunition?
Yeah, it's a big bandolier. It isn't two bandoliers. Yeah. It's just one big one with a lot of 30, 20 rounds in it. But then after the first day, the lieutenant's runner disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. And so he selected me to be his runner. And one night, our own artillery made a mistake and was laying in on our lines, and we couldn't get communication back to him, to the headquarters.
So you're in a foxhole or something, and your own American artillery is coming right where you guys are camped out.
And so the lieutenant sent me back to headquarters in the dark to get him to stop the artillery. And it's dark, and you don't go running around through the lines very much in the dark. So I was pretty scared then, and I took off and was running and hollering as I went. So I wanted them to know I was coming through. Runner coming through, then I'd holler the password. And I fell down a couple times, skinned my knees. And then I went back up to the company, and the lieutenant says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I come back up here." He said, "I thought you'd stay down there till daylight."
And you said, "Well, if I knew I could, I probably would have, huh?"
Well, I didn't even think about that. I just thought they needed me.
You know, you lived it, and I'm sure you've told that story a couple times to your family, so it's not a big deal to you, but I'm just imagining being this teenager in that situation. Like you said, it's dark, and you mentioned the password, and that's, I think, an important point, because there was probably as much danger of you being killed by your own guys as the enemy, right?
Right, definitely. That was why I was hollering and let them know that somebody was coming through, and they knew the password. Now, that password was changed every day,
right,
so that the enemy couldn't get a hold of it.
What kinds of things were used as passwords? Do you have any examples maybe of what those might have been?
Something like the Lone Ranger, or just odd things like that. Something about baseball, or I can't remember of any of them that we used, but they had a lot of them.
Well, the Lone Ranger would have been pretty fitting for what you were doing there, running through the dark and falling down.
That was just the quickest thing I could think of right now.
And messages weren't the only thing that you had to carry. I know you weren't a medic, but I understand that you did have a situation where you were asked to carry a wounded Marine. What happened there?
The enemy cut in with anti-aircraft and exploding it over the top of us. That was a little herring. And one of our guys got hit bad. And, of course, I was selected because I was a runner to help carry him back out of there. I don't know whether he ever made it or not.
So this is, again, in the dark. You're trying to get some sleep or trying to get some rest, and all of a sudden, tell me what that looked like, what it sounded like.
You're not resting when they're shooting anti-aircraft at you. But, yeah, you're scared.
So these are air bursts over the top of your position?
But after a while, you know it's a danger, but the bad fear goes away. You know, you're scared, but you're not paralyzed by it.
What made that transition? What enabled you to not feel that fear?
Just like the first time you go into a football game, you're all excited. After you get in there, all the fear goes away. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go away, but the danger, you just control it. That's all I can say.
Well, we're going to pick up that story when we come back, because it is break time. And hey, speaking of football games, Warren is going to be the special guest at one next week. If you live in California's Central Valley like Warren does, you can see him at the Fresno State football game against Southern Utah Saturday night, September 20th. He's going to be the hero of the game, and he'll be recognized at halftime in 41,000-seat Bulldog Stadium. I'm going to be there, of course, and if you're in the Fresno area and you find yourself at that game, keep your eye out for Warren, and that hero of the game is something that you might have guessed is going to happen at all of Fresno State's home games. So if there's a veteran that you think should be considered, you can email the sponsor. I have the link at hometownheroesradio.com. But if you think you can remember this email address for the sponsor of the hero of the game, it's heroes@solarnegotiators.com. That's heroes@solarnegotiators.com. Again, I've got the link up on hometownheroesradio.com. And hey, good for Solar Negotiators for sponsoring those heroes of the game. We're talking about things to come in 2014, but we're going to head back to 1944 when we come back. We'll hear more of that situation that Warren found himself in, and we'll also find out how he ended up getting wounded on Saipan. Hometown Heroes comes right back at you after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 89-year-old Warren Smith of Fresno, California. He served with I Company, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marine Division during World War II, getting his first taste of combat on Saipan, where he went ashore as an assistant BAR man and was pressed into duty as a runner after the lieutenant's previous runner disappeared. Before we jump back into his personal perspective, how about a little overview on Saipan? We've heard from plenty of veterans over the years on this program who served on that island. And between the 2nd Marine Division, 4th Marine Division, and the 27th Infantry Division, there were more than 70,000 Americans fighting a little more than 30,000 troops of the Japanese Imperial Army on an island that doesn't quite cover 45 square miles in the Northern Mariana Islands. Saipan remains U.S. territory today, and if you visit there, you'll find a couple of sites that are on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. That would be Suicide Cliff and Bonsai Cliff, two spots where some of World War II's most tragic moments unfolded. As Americans were overpowering the Japanese forces on Saipan, there were a couple of motivating factors that led civilians, both Japanese and the native inhabitants of Saipan, the Chamorros, to jump off of those two cliffs to their deaths. You might remember there was Japanese propaganda telling the civilians about the horrible things American soldiers might do to them. Of course, that was not true. And there was also an imperial order from Emperor Hirohito telling civilians that their status in the afterlife would increase if they committed suicide there rather than be taken prisoner. It's really not pleasant to talk about, but it's one of the things that the Battle of Saipan is most remembered for. Strategically, Saipan was a very important victory for American forces. It enabled them to move within striking distance of mainland Japan. B-29s from Saipan and, of course, nearby Tinian were bombarding the Philippines and Japan not long after those islands were secured. Our guest today, Warren Smith, was part of that effort to win that battle that lasted from June 15th to July 9th, 1944. And let's get back to his story now. Warren, when we left off, you mentioned having to evacuate a wounded Marine. So the enemy's exploding artillery shells over your position. This guy is hit bad. He's bleeding all over. and you guys put them on a stretcher and you had to get them out of there. Of course, the enemy's still firing. And what do you remember about the condition this wounded Marine was in?
He was pretty bad. I never really heard what happened to him, but he was in pretty bad shape. We was going back to the medical station. All I can remember is starting carrying him down there. The rest of it I cannot recollect. As is, whether we came back up to our unit or not, I don't know.
When you see something like that, and you're carrying him, you know, on the stretcher, so you're close enough to see what his condition is and what that's doing to him. And does that make you think, boy, what if this happens to me? This could happen to me?
That's right. You think, oh, Ben, that could have been me.
What about the day-to-day conditions on Saipan? What kinds of things you were dealing with? What the enemy was like? What do you remember about that?
Our condition wasn't all that bad. We were short of water for a couple of days, and all we was got a canteen probably a day, and you'd take a pour your water in the canteen lid and sip that down, try to make it last, and then it got, and the water tasted terrible. It tested like sulfur water that you find different places in the country here now.
It doesn't sound like a very pleasant place to be. What do you think enabled you to keep going and to not just get down and miserable and scared and paralyzed by that fear and desperation?
That's something that I don't know. You're just, it's a job that has to be done, and everybody else is doing it with you.
Well, that's what I wondered, if that was part of it, if there was some strength in numbers or knowing that the guy next to you is going through the same thing.
I'm sure that's part of it, yes.
And you said that when that battle started, you were thinking, when's this going to be over? How am I going to get out of here? I know it didn't end the way for you that you wanted it to, but when you spent day after day in those conditions, you know, sleeping outdoors in this, you know, tropical island, did it seem like it was going to last forever? Did you have any expectation that it was getting close to over?
I can't remember of even thinking about when it would be over, really. Yeah. I'd just be glad when it is over. And as far as our conditions, we C rations, they weren't too bad, or K rations. And they brought up hot food once in a while. So it wasn't bad like some of them did in the Guadalcanal when they were short of food and had a hard time getting them in there.
What was your impression of the guys that you were fighting against, of what the enemy was like and what you had to be prepared for?
I don't know whether I had any feeling about them or not. I just know that they was the enemy and they were doing what they'd been told to do. That is all I can say about them. I said, if you shot at somebody, there other people was shooting at him too, so you don't know whether you hit him or other people hit him.
Yeah, I guess that's the hard thing for us who haven't been in those combat situations to understand how chaotic it is.
Police officers, that is bad for them. That is bad after they have to shoot somebody. I can't imagine what they go through.
But because of the situation you were in, you felt it was a little different?
Well, yeah, they were our enemy. They were a different situation, you know. And you had to hunt them out. They would throw a grenade at you. They would kill themselves before they would let you capture them. Yeah. Most of them did. We captured a few. Mm-hmm. But I went through one cave after the island was secure months afterwards, and there was a cave in there. There was probably 100 people that had killed themselves with their rifles, tie a string to their toe and stick it in their mouth.
I'm sure you saw a lot of things that that you'd never seen before and maybe have never seen since. How long was it until you were wounded? Because this was the battle where they got a piece of you, right?
We landed June the 15th, and I was evacuated on July the 8th.
Tell me about that. What happened? How were you hurt?
Well, we had pushed them out into the ocean, and there was some trying to escape, and there was a group of civilians here. And there was one old soldier that somebody had shot, and somebody got wounded, so I was guarding till they got him out of there. And I got hit in the leg, whether it was enemy fire or our own fire, I don't know. Everybody was firing. That's about all I can say.
So you got hit in the leg. Did you feel pain, or was it just...
More like somebody hits you and gives you a Charlie horse, and I grabbed it like that. And there was a kind of a knot there like you can get. And then I looked at my hand and there was blood on it. And so somebody hollered for a medic. And he started doctoring the front of my leg. And I said, I'm hit back here. Well, the thing had went clear through, and I hadn't noticed that, you know.
Wow.
Didn't break no bones. It went through between the bones, so I didn't suffer any real damage.
Is that something that you look back on and you're thankful because it could have been a lot worse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have no ill effects of it today. Hmm. Never did have.
And that was, if I remember right, July 8th was just about the end of that battle, wasn't it?
Probably 2 weeks it went on. They had pushed them on out to the end of the island, and they was jumping over the cliffs and killing their family and stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't get in on any of that.
Well, and you bring that up, and I was going to ask you about that because so many people who are on Saipan have mentioned that. And the context was the Japanese were telling the natives this propaganda that what you guys were going to do to them was worse than jumping off that cliff. When you found out about that, I know you've seen death. You've been around these battles and the carnage, but to find out that these mothers and children were jumping off that cliff, how hard was that to swallow?
You just couldn't imagine that people would be doing that to themselves when we weren't going to hurt them at all. And by the way, there was a few Japanese soldiers that did surrender. I think there was probably.
So you're wounded, you get evacuated. I'm sure they took good care of you. And then how much longer did you stay on Saipan?
Oh, I was left the next day. They sent me out to hospital ship and took me down to New Caledonia and stayed down there. Then they sent me back to Hawaii, and I don't know when I got there, and I don't know when I joined the unit again. But I know when we got hit with a suicide plane.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, too. Was it hard for you to leave those other guys you'd been fighting with when you were wounded and evacuated? Were you thinking about them still out there fighting these Japanese?
Oh, maybe a little, not much. But you think about them. And two, I hadn't been with them that long, really. No, there was still a lot of them in the unit when I got back to them.
And once you get wounded like that, I've had different guys tell me different things about them. Some of them say, well, I figure it was only a matter of time till I was going to get hit again. And some of them say, well, you know, if that's the worst that's going to happen, maybe I'm going to be all right. You know, did it make you feel worse or better or neither?
No, it made me feel any different at all. But I know when we found out that the war was over, everybody went wild. We was out on maneuvers, and of course nobody knew what an atomic bomb was and how much damage it had done. And I remember thinking, well, I can take my rifle and shoot and sink a battleship with it. Should've got that much explosives. But we found out it wasn't quite like that.
Yeah, not exactly. I do want to hear about how that all happened and what you remember about the end of the war, but you had some other hair-raising moments while the war was still going on. Whether or not your rifle works correctly can be a matter of life or death, and I know you had two different rifles, as many did, the M1 Garand as well as a carbine. You had an incident that I think if our listeners are paying attention to, they're going to feel a bit of the panic that you might have felt in the moment. You were on guard duty?
One night, you got somebody on guard all the time, you know. And so I seen a Jap running towards us, and I thought, well, I'm going to let him get close enough, coming right for us, that I know I can get him if it's a Japanese. And so I hollered halt, and he turned to run, and I pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. Cocked it again, pulled the trigger, nothing happened. Well, I picked up my M1 and shot, but he was clear out of range in here where I couldn't see him. And I was using the carbine. That's the lighter one. And it had dirt in the bolt, so the bolt wouldn't go clear shut.
Yeah.
And if it had been the M1, it would have shammed right on in there. But
yeah.
I hated that thing from then on.
Well, hey, at least it didn't cost you your life, huh?
And then there was one night, there was me and a corporal and our lieutenant was in one shell hole. And I guess I was dreaming or something. They said, I woke up and grabbed the lieutenant by the leg and started shaking and saying, they're coming, they're coming, they're coming. And they said, he said, I laid back down and just laughed and went on sleeping.
I haven't heard that one before. I've heard of the flashbacks after you get home, but that's a new one.
He was a good guy, that lieutenant was. And he got killed before the fight was over. His dad was a judge in Chicago, and he had condemned a couple kids to death penalty for something they'd done. Right about the same time.
I can't imagine what that must have been like for him, and I really can't fathom being in your shoes either. It can't be easy when you're losing men like that whom you respect, and you're getting shot at, you're missing all the comforts of home, and it kind of sounds like you just got used to all of that.
That was just the thing we put up with. But as far as the food, I don't can't complain about our food one bit. You know, the enemy would like to have had our K-rations. It's just like in Europe, they got some prisoners and they come back there, and here guys are got soda, a kitchen set up to them, and a lot of equipment. And they said, well, how in the hell did they ever expect to win this war with this type of stuff going on? People was happy, you know. You know, they didn't even think about having Cokes and stuff to drink, you know.
All about perspective. So you're wounded, you recuperate, you rejoin your unit, and you guys were heading into Okinawa on an LST?
Yes, on an LST. We got up there and we was a diversionary landing. Made it run like we was going to land. And you could see the trucks and stuff pulling into the beach where they thought we was going to land. And then the main invasion was on the other side. And so we had an air raid. And whenever you have air raids on ship, they said they want you below deck because you're less apt to get hurt down there than you are on deck. And then the plane hit. They had us come up.
Well, hold on a second here. So this is Okinawa, and probably of all the battles in the Pacific, the one the most infamous for kamikazes was Okinawa. So you're below deck. You can't see anything coming. You don't know what's happening. How did you experience this kamikaze attack?
Well, you just heard the thing hit the ship, and that's about all. And then the ship was on fire, and they wanted us on deck. They had gasoline drums up there, and they wanted us to throw the gasoline drums overboard, and one of our sergeants was grabbing them 50-gallon buns and throwing them over. Ended up, he was throwing the empty ones over.
Well, and you can laugh about that now, but I'm imagining being there. You're below deck. A kamikaze crashes into the ship armed with a 500-pound bomb that could detonate, and they want you to go find the explosive material and throw it overboard? I mean, the last thing I would want to do is get near any gas at that point.
They wanted it off of there so it wouldn't explode and burn us all up, you know.
Right.
They had a lot of liquid up there, yeah. So they wanted to get rid of it.
So you're up on the deck. There's a fire burning on another part of the ship, and you're throwing gasoline overboard.
Drums, yeah. Until they told us to abandon ship.
That sounds like a pretty scary and panic situation to me. What do you remember about it?
All I can remember is just shoving the drums over, get them off of here. That's the only thing I can remember of thinking about it.
And how close was the fire to you?
It was down below deck, down in the engine room.
So they say abandon ship, and you're on the deck of an LST. That's not like stepping off into a wading pool. That's a long way down to the water, right?
Not as far as the troop ships are. And
they
were the same way.
They say abandon ship. What do?
Put on your life jacket. Well, you already had your life belt on. You just jump over and press the thing to inflate it. And that's the ball deal. And we was picked up by a tug, which had the best food I ever had in my life. We was crowded up there like fleas on a cat.
I mean, you're making this sound like no big deal. But I mean, that sounds crazy to me. How far down to the water was it from the edge of that LST?
It wasn't that far, really. You don't even think about it anyhow, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't like getting up on a big platform and jumping off into the swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
You just jump.
And you were picked up almost immediately, or you had to float for a while?
A little bit, 30 minutes or something like that. One guy, he inflated his life belt before he jumped over because he couldn't swim. And when he hit the water, it was up and it busted the thing and it fell off of him. And he's swimming away and doing fine. And he discovered that was fine. That was gone. And he said he started going down and he told himself, he said, well, you're doing all right before, get back up. And he got back up and somebody picked him up, you know,
wow.
Somebody that had a life jacket.
But you don't remember having to wonder if you were going to get picked up?
No, there was a lot of ships. We were right close to shore, so. There was a lot of ships around there. Before we got hit, I can remember some of the planes, Japanese planes being way high. A particular one, he'd start to dive down and they'd get his range and he'd go back up. And finally he came clear on down and missed the ship that he was trying to hit. But like I was telling Jeff, these were not really trained people to kamikaze. They were just regular pilots. So he was naturally trying to get away from it for a while. The ones that was a kamikaze, that was all they were supposed to do, was find a ship, get on a plane, fly it. That's all they wanted to know. Fly there and hit the ship.
You know, I've read one estimate that only 19% of kamikaze pilots were able to actually crash their planes into ships. Kamikaze in Japanese means divine wind. And as a strategy, employing those suicide planes was something that increased dramatically the more desperate the situation got toward the end of the war. There were reportedly 5,000 additional kamikaze pilots on standby when Japan surrendered. But during the war, approximately 3,800 of them died in attempted attacks on enemy targets. Nearly 1,500 of those were part of a single battle, Okinawa, the spot where Warren Smith and his LST were hit. That's not the end of his story, though. We'll talk about the rest of his time in World War II and another adventure he's been able to enjoy just in the past year. Remember, if you're listening in Central California and you're headed to that Fresno State football game next Saturday against Southern Utah, Warren is going to be the hero of the game. Look for him at halftime. And if you don't want to wait that long to see what he looks like, you can find photos of him right now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and, of course, at hometownheroesradio.com. And Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 89-year-old Warren Smith of Fresno, California, originally from Raton, New Mexico. That's a city of about 7,000 now on Interstate 25 near the Colorado border. He shared how he rode horses to school as a young boy there before moving out to California. He was just a teenager when he headed to Saipan with the 2nd Marine Division, just 19 when he was wounded there in July of 1944. He told us about that. And before the break, he told us about surviving a kamikaze attack on the LST he was on just off the coast of Okinawa. I want to save a little time to ask him about his experience with Honor Flight before we're done. But let's jump back in where we left off before the break. So after that incident where your ship was hit by the kamikaze, what did they do with you for the rest of the war?
The rest of the war, they sent us back to Saipan, and we trained some more for the invasion of Japan.
And you say the invasion of Japan, and folks know that it never happened, but I'm sure to you at the time it probably seemed awfully real.
Well, yeah, it seemed real. Of course, we didn't know it was for, we was going to Japan. We didn't know what we was training for. But they expected the first wave to be annihilated, and one general was mad because he wasn't going to be on the first wave, and when he found out what the thing was, he wasn't that disgusted about it.
Yeah, well, the official government intelligence was that at least 1 million Americans would have died and countless more Japanese. And I've talked to guys who were actually went ashore in some of those same spots where the invasions would have been, and they saw the Japanese guns that were lined up ready to mow people down. You saw that too?
I seen where we was going to invade, and they had some good crossfire that would really pick us off.
So I imagine that leaves very little doubt in your mind that the atomic bomb might have saved your life?
I'm pretty near certain of it, just pretty near certain of it, because we were going to be the first wave.
Is that humbling? Does that take your breath away a little bit to think about that?
Well, not really. I just think, oh, Ben, boy, we were lucky. We were lucky. There was a story that a Japanese girl wrote, and I got the book here somewhere, that she was talking about them training for the invasion, high school kids. Yeah. And she says, all I can say is hooray for the atomic bomb. Says, I had friends that got killed by it, but she says, I know it saved a lot of lives.
And you really can make a case that it saved more lives than it took, without question. And yours clearly was one of those. And you started to tell me earlier about the way that news played out. So you're on Saipan training when you get the news that this bomb's been dropped, and then shortly after the news that Japan has surrendered. How did you guys celebrate over there?
Hey, just raising a lot of hell, you know. And of course, up in Okinawa, they were shooting a lot of stuff in the air, and a few people got hit and killed.
So I'm sure you're thinking, okay, when do I get to go home, right?
Right. I didn't get here for Christmas, but I got here shortly after Christmas in 45.
Oh, and speaking of Christmas, you did say that the day you guys got hit on Okinawa, that was Easter Sunday?
Easter Sunday.
Had that held any kind of meaning for you at that time?
Nothing other than I can just remember it easy.
And getting to Japan, how long were you there, and what were you doing there?
We was just there for guard duty mainly. we went out looking for tanks and stuff, you know, and we was there blowing up their airplanes and stuff like that. So there was no big excitement there. I only went out on Liberty once there because I was just a little bit scared of them. And I didn't want them to get me back in one of their alleys.
After everything you've been through, you didn't want that to be the way the story ended, huh?
I couldn't blame them for being mad the way some of our troops was treating their women, you know, and so that would have made me mad too if it had happened here.
Did you interact with them at all, any of the Japanese?
Well, they were very obedient, I guess you would say. They were told to surrender, and they surrendered, and that was it.
So getting to come home, what was that like to see America again after all the time that you'd spent overseas?
Great. It was really a nice time to get home again. We had a rough time on ship coming home because we went up through the Aleutians, and it was real stormy up there. You get in bed, and you just have to hang on. Keep from getting thrown out of bed. But we landed in San Diego, and then they transported us up to Mare Island for the discharge.
When you think back on that time in your life, and again, you went in as a teenager, what do you think it did for you? What do you think you gained from the experience?
That is a hard one to think about. I never did think about it, other than I just knew that I was glad to be back in America.
And you've got, two children, two grandchildren, three great-grandchildren? That ever hit you that none of them would be here if you hadn't survived that bullet in Saipan?
Yes, I think about it, and I'm just glad that I'm here to have them.
And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I know a lot of people have different takes on it, and I've heard them all. But when you think back about some of those moments, the artillery fire from your own guys that was heading into your lines, the Japanese fire, and you have to evacuate people, getting hit yourself, did you feel like someone or something was protecting you?
Oh, I don't know whether I did or not. I just knew that I hadn't got hit, and I got back home. Just thankful that I got home.
What about now? You've had a few years to think about it since, like about 70 of them.
Somebody must have been looking over me. All I can say is somebody must have been looking over me.
You know, I've heard the few, the proud, the Marines. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Semper Fi. What makes you proud? What are you proud of when you think about the time you spent in the Marine Corps in World War II?
Just happy I was in the service for the country. Am I happy, proud of the Marines? Yeah, but I'm proud of all the rest of the service people, all of them. Every one of them did what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons that I do this show is to help those of us who are a little younger who weren't alive then understand what it was that helped America and its allies win World War II. What is it that you think we need to know that made America special at that time, that earned that label of the greatest generation?
Oh, let me think about that a minute. Now, ask that question again.
What made your generation the greatest generation? I'm pretty sure you believe it wasn't just the guys in uniform, but it was bigger than that. What's your explanation of what made America great at that time?
Because I think most of Americans was proud of America, and they wanted to do everything that they could to help us. They had gas rationing, and that wasn't for the gas. That was for the rubber, so they wouldn't use up their tires and stuff. And if they'd had all the gas they wanted and rationed the tires, which they tried to, they'd go ahead and wear them out and then have to walk, and they couldn't get to their jobs.
Did you ever hear from your family while you were overseas?
I heard from them a lot more than they heard from me. But yeah, my family wrote a lot.
What did that mean to you when you got something from home?
It was just nice to have mail call, that's all. I should have wrote more. My mother was worried sick, and I didn't write as much as I should. And then they got the telegram that I'd been wounded, and didn't explain what or anything, and was supposed to follow up. Well, they never did. They never followed up. And I guess that's the way with all of them, because I know a Japanese guy that his brother was called into the Korean War, and they notified his mother that he was missing in action. They never notified her anything, and they never got anything.
So with your mother, your family, you mentioned them getting the telegram and then nothing else. So did she not know how badly you were hurt until you showed back up?
Well, yeah, I did let them know that I was back in the unit. And when I went to New Caledonia, I rode them from there, and then I was transferred back to Hawaii, and I had a cousin there that was working there in the office, and I seen her, and she went to my mother and stuff, so she knew that I was all right and was going back to work.
If there's anything else that comes to mind, feel free to pop it in there, but I want to ask you about a recent journey that you had. You didn't go quite as far as Saipan, but you went to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. And there's a picture here of you and your daughter in front of the Marine Corps Memorial, that giant statue of the Marines atop Mount Suribachi. I'm sure that was a meaningful moment for you. What did you get out of that trip to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial and so many other things?
It was an exciting moment to see what we had done and everything that we had back there in Washington, D.C. that everybody should get a chance to see. And they, if they get a chance, they need to do it.
You don't seem to me to be an overly emotional guy, but I'm guessing there were some points in that whole journey, whether it was the way there, everything you saw there, or the way home with the letters you got from family members thanking you, or the great crowd that welcomed you at the airport.
All those above. Yeah. It was the crowd that was there, the crowd when you was seeing the statues and stuff, and the thing there that had 4,000 search stars.
Gold stars.
The little kids that come up and want to shake your hand, want to take pictures with you. That was all really made you feel good.
What made you the most emotional, or made you feel like what you did really mattered?
I think the little kids coming up and wanting to get a picture with you and thanking you was probably the most emotional thing. And you think, well, man, these kids, they do know that something had happened in the world, don't they?
You mentioned the gold stars. Representing more than 400,000 Americans who died in the war, and you came close enough to add into that number. What do you think we should remember about those men who paid with their lives? How often do you think about that?
Well, that's been 50 years ago, and I think that we need to thank them for their contribution to the war effort, to the freedom of America. We've had these kind of things before. World War One, the Civil War, that was a terrible one. They didn't have the medication to take care of them then that they had with us.
Yeah.
And it's the same now. We keep developing things, and people there that get wounded in Iraq and are bad wounds. But just glad I'm here.
Well, so am I. And I want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling me a little bit of your story. Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for after all these years, your time in the war, the cotton fields, milking cows, driving truck? You've done a lot. What are you most thankful for?
Just being alive and living in this country. That's about all you can think about.
And what keeps you so sharp? Because I think people listening to you talk, they're thinking, no, that guy's not 89. What's going on here?
Just luck. That's all. Just good luck. Good genes.
And a good Marine, Warren Smith. Before I sign off, just a little more about Honor Flight, which takes veterans like Warren free of charge to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial. Remember, it doesn't matter where you live. Chances are there is an Honor Flight hub right in your area, and you can find all of them listed at honorflight.org. That's honorflight.org. For example, if you're here at the show in the Bakersfield area, Honor Flight Kern County is going to send another flight September 20th through the 22nd. And if you're in the Fresno area, like Mr. Smith is, your chance to welcome home a group of about 70 World War II vets will come Wednesday night. This coming Wednesday night, September 17th, be at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport by about 6:30, and you can be part of that goosebump-inducing crowd. Really, it gives me goosebumps every single time. And just imagine what it means to these World War II veterans, most of them in their 90s, when a loud and proud red, white, and blue crowd welcomes them home. I want to thank Warren's nephew, Jeff Smith. Maybe you've done business with him at MDS Doors. Jeff let me know about his uncle's Marine Corps story. If you have a vet in your life that you think I ought to interview, send me an email, paul@hometownheroesradio.com. That's paul@hometownheroesradio.com. And you never know, I might be headed to your area. Like all you listening on the Rock of Talk in Albuquerque, I'm going to be in your neck of the woods at the end of the month and look forward to meeting some very special veterans there. Time to say goodbye. Thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.